This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America Secret Wars, the podcast all about the forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately covered up times the United States has used military forces to fight or occupy foreign nations. I am your host, Trevor Cully, and today I am once again joined by Bailey and Nick from Totalis Jeffianus. How are you both doing?
Well, we are still here.
Yeah. You're still Canadian, which we weren't sure of a couple episodes ago.
Although it is looking dicey because our PM just declared for an election. And Trump, of course, had something to say on the matter. He said that he will not be talking to any Canadian officials until the election is done. So for another month and 4 days, Trump is going to pretend that Canada has no leader. So
cool.
How yeah. nice.
Cool. This is,
I mean, okay, if we want our moment of good news, because of the tariffs, all Canadians have stopped buying all American stuff. Like, we're all in like a boycott of anything coming out of the States, but that doesn't mean stuff from the States isn't coming in. So American produce has been flooding our food banks. And I know this because I work at the food bank. So we've had a lot more produce come in, a lot cheaper, and we're able to give it to people who need it. So there is your good news for the day.
So thank you, America.
We got rid of USAID and inadvertently started sending it to Canada.
Yes. Yes.
So if anybody couldn't tell, this is our first recording since things really started ramping up.
Since the trade war has officially begun.
Begun the trade war has.
The great trade war of 2025, so they'll call it.
The king has offered to let the U.S. join the Commonwealth of Nations so that he can act as the mediator in this nonsense.
Is that real?
Yeah. And then Alan from U.S. Political History was like, I hope that happens just so that my podcast can have a nice little cyclical bow at the end of it.
Weirdly, for a guy who's like, I'm going to take shit and I'm going to make deals, Trump was like, that sounds all right.
Yeah.
It's so weird because he wants to leave every organization that America was in.
But
except the Commonwealth, apparently.
We knew they'd come back.
I'm wondering if he thinks he can somehow finagle that into becoming king, but...
Oh, absolutely. That's entirely what
he's thinking. They can have him.
Yeah.
I will say, since 2016, I have been saying King Donald I, and everyone's laughed at me, and everyone said, nope, you're wrong. But just wait, we got 4 years.
So all I'm hearing is you did this to us. You manifested this.
Exactly.
Have you seen the Twitter account Donneld the Unready?
No.
No, but that sounds great.
It does parody posts of news stories about Trump. Like, it was started back in 2016, but in the style of like a late Anglo-Saxon monarch.
Thank God.
But we are not here to talk about the impending invasion of Canada. We're talking about previous invasions of Canada.
We should line it up, though, for when the invasion happens. We could be recording so we can get like a live
updates from the front.
Yeah. Oh, if you look, it looks like they just, oh, God.
Right.
Vancouver, it's been hit.
Because remember, if the United States does invade Canada, like, that's your apartment.
Yeah, we're like, I can see you.
Woohoo. So this is the finale of our 5-part series on the Anglo-American border crises in the 1800s.
We made it.
What a ride it's been.
We have had 5 separatist republics, an American stabbing a Canadian judge, a battle in a place called Caribou, where the most violent combatant was a bear, a Canadian militia running circles around the U.S. and British armies in Detroit, Michigan, and American presidents just fucking up royally on the issue of slavery over and over again with the case of the Creole self-emancipation.
There we go. It's been a journey, to say the least.
And somehow all of this was spun out of, oh, Indian Stream seems neat.
Oh, research, never change.
Oh, boy. I didn't know we were going to talk about it in real life, too. It was just supposed to be a fun podcast thing.
When's that long YouTube documentary on the rabbit hole iceberg?
Yeah. This whole show is like already the beneath the water part of any iceberg.
Oh, yeah.
So today we are finally moving beyond all of the various border disputes that brought us the Webster-Ashburton Treaty. International relations are now much better defined, and the U.S.-Canadian border is actually a thing with like instructions on paper for how to draw it.
Wow.
I've heard it's pretty long.
It goes all the way from Maine and New Brunswick to the Rocky Mountains, at which point the definition of the border starts to break down again. There are military sharing agreements, extradition agreements, and slavery loopholes for both sides to continue fucking with one another on a small scale.
Nice!
It's just about as right with the world as mid-1800s America tends to get. The thing is, both the United States and British Canada went west of the Rocky Mountains, as you two might be aware.
It's a little bit past that.
I've been a little west.
As someone who's a little bit past the Rocky Mountains, I think you're onto something. We live in a country.
On that note, have either of you ever heard of Vancouver?
Vancouver, Washington?
That also comes up, weirdly enough.
Oh, well.
Is it Vancouver with a U or without a U?
It depends on if you're British or not.
Oh.
Welcome to Vancouver. I guarantee there's an American town named Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
Vancouver?
Okay.
I just met her.
Nope. See, I knew that tone of voice immediately.
Nick and I both just stopped and stared at Bailey.
I'll be honest, for the listener's benefit, I just got 2 glaring death stares.
They were powerful, if I do say so myself.
So, we last saw the U.S.-Canadian border in 1842. That is when they signed the Webster-Ashburton Treaty, which drew a nice straight line along the 49th parallel from Lake of the Woods in modern Minnesota to some vaguely defined point on the western side of the Rocky Mountains. Mm. Because Daniel Webster and Lord Ashburton just could not get their respective countries to agree on how to handle anything past that. And at the time, it wasn't worth dragging out all of the other disputes. So they signed the treaty and said, we'll deal with that later.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Put a pin in that. We'll circle back.
So my question for my Canadian friends is, what was the area west of the Rocky Mountains along that border called in 1842?
Ooh, I'm going to say right now that I moved here 5 years ago and I'm from Toronto, so I have no idea.
So 5 years ago was still after the year 1842. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you missed that part.
Yep. But I'll be honest, I didn't even know there was a city of Vancouver.
So for our purposes today, I am going to call it the Oregon Country, though its official name in British documents of the time was the Columbia District, which is where we get British Columbia now.
Oh, that makes sense.
But the Oregon Country covers a broader definition of things, which is why I'm going to stick with it. Also, fuck Christopher Columbus.
Fuck that guy.
Wait, is that why the train station, like one stop down, is called Columbia?
Yes.
Interesting.
That's the only reason.
Yeah.
So let's rewind. The Oregon Country was probably one of the first places that human beings reached in North America, with evidence of settlement going back at least 15,000 years. By extension, there were tons of indigenous cultures in the area long before Europeans even knew it existed.
This is the oldest pair of shoes, right? I remember that the earliest discoveries, there's a really old, old pair of shoes that were found around here, like children's shoes.
Yeah, oldest pair of shoes. At one point, there was a contender for the oldest human body ever found in the Americas.
I'm guessing on the shoes, there was a little check mark. Little Nike's first shoe.
The ancient shoes in the Pacific Northwest, I think those were Reeboks.
Oh, yes.
Okay, makes sense. It's more of a...
The ones on the East Coast, those were New Balances. Yeah.
And everything in the Slavic countries has always been Adidas.
Well, look at the mountains.
So unlike some of the relatively isolated areas we've talked about in this series, there were tons of conflicts between European colonizers and the locals in this area. But we don't really have time to do that justice because it's temporally pretty far removed from the topic at hand.
Yeah. One of those things where you could have a whole podcast just on this region.
And I will cover many of those conflicts at a later date. It's just not what we're doing today.
Fair enough.
So I don't know about you, but I always kind of assumed that Oregon was another indigenous place name in the U.S.
Yeah.
It turns out it probably is not, at least not directly. One option is that it gained traction after a map maker did a very bad job of spelling and formatting the label for the Wisconsin River, which is also transliterated as Wisconsin.
Oh.
And it made it look like there was a river called the Ouaricon in the Pacific Northwest. That river does not exist.
Yeah, if you hit that with a hard American accent, I can see how you can come up with Oregon.
Just poorly formatted map making, basically.
Yeah.
Wisconsin, for what it's worth, is an Algonquin name. Mm. Other options for Oregon include the French word for hurricane, Oregon, which I can see it. Referencing indigenous stories about powerful winds along one of the rivers in the Northwest. But most of the suggestions, from the Big Ear of Mexico to Hear the Waters or the Land of Oregano, all go back to Spanish words for their origins.
Oh.
Huh. Okay.
That is because, like most of the Americas, Spain got there first.
Yeah.
What?
Early Spanish expeditions going north from Mexico actually had trouble getting that far north. The currents were just too difficult to navigate once you got past California. So early coastal exploration by the Europeans went the long way around, sailing up from the Philippines across the northern Pacific and then back down.
Whoa.
Wow. You know why that's so crazy?
Because it's crazy.
Well, here, like, a large group of the original inhabitants that lived here, they were whale hunters, and they were on their little boats in these rapid waters hunting whales, while like the Western world was having a hard time just riding up the coast.
Yeah, well, when your boat weighs, you know, 100 tons and is powered by wind, like
yeah,
you have a harder time than when you have a, you know, a 9-pound boat with an oar. Now, did they ever try just, you know, using a rowboat? No, but
no, they're not savages. We have big boats.
You can't bring a cannon if we take the rowboat.
You can, it would just really weigh you down.
Might run into the same problem at that point. So over time, French fur trappers started making their way to the area and exploring more inland. And they were soon joined by British fur trappers from a noted Canadian department store and owner of such American stores as Saks Fifth Avenue, the Hudson Bay Company.
Which has gone bankrupt as of this week and is closing all locations.
About goddamn time.
Wait, I gotta find, there was this, so we have like a Canadian version of The Onion, and it was like, local indigenous leaders band together to offer to purchase the Hudson's Bay Company for a blanket.
That seems fair.
And some unrolled tobacco.
Well, can't give them the rolled stuff. That's far too rich for their blood.
Oh, of course.
So by the 1730s, Russia had colonized and conquered northern Asia all the way to the Pacific and started poking around so far to the east that the rest of the world considers it the West. Basically, there was this great big stretch of territory that makes up most of the west coast of Canada and the United States that all of the European powers were interested in, but they were also way too far away to actually do anything.
Is this the little bit that's right under Alaska that like still like cuts into BC?
It's most of the Alaskan coast all the way down to like modern California.
Wow.
Oh, okay, cool. Like the whole thing.
The like the entire coast of Alaska, Canada, Washington, and Oregon.
Yeah, cool. Cool.
France dropped out of this picture first, in that they never really claimed ownership of the Oregon country in the first place. French fur traders really wanted their government to press the issue, but they gave it up with the Louisiana Territory to Spain after the Seven Years' War. And when France got that back after the American Revolution, they just didn't ask for Oregon.
Well,
yeah, admittedly, the French were a bit busy at this time.
Yeah, I mean, the United States would have just bought it back anyway.
Yeah.
When the United States became independent, we almost immediately laid a claim to the Oregon country, even though there was no direct land connection for another few decades until Napoleon did the Louisiana Purchase thing. And that is how the first major military flashpoint over this region happened before the U.S. could realistically get anybody there, all the way back in 1789. It happened on a little island you two might be familiar with called Vancouver, although it was called Nootka at the time. And have either of you ever heard of the Nootka Crisis?
Actually, I think I have. So in Victoria, where Bailey and I lived there for 7 years. Bailey, you were there for what, four?
Yeah.
There's a little museum. It's the Natural History Museum of the Royal Blah. And they have a whole section dedicated to like the indigenous cultures of the surrounding area. And they had recently revamped it. And I think there was something on this. It rings a bell,
right,
at least. I've heard the word Nootka before, which is, I think, a step in the right direction.
If there is going to be a museum with an Indigenous peoples exhibit in Vancouver, it should really include the Nootka, because they are the First Nations from that island. The Spanish claim to the Oregon country and all of its colonies really rested on the Treaty of Tordesillas that the Pope brokered between Spain and Portugal in 1493.
Oh, I'm glad the Pope was involved.
Yeah, you know, that makes it official.
Shout out to the Pope.
This also, for anybody wondering, Pope Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope. So,
yeah. Oh, that was him? Oh, that blew my mind. I thought he was like 150 years earlier.
No, this was Rodrigo Borgia who brokered the treaty that gave Spain most of North America.
Wow.
This was basically as soon as they found out there were continents over here at all. Strictly speaking, that gave Spain all of the Americas except for Brazil, and everything else had been taken by other European countries by force over the years.
That doesn't seem like them, though.
No, Europeans taking by force?
No, I just... Yeah, I don't know where this came from.
I did have to Google who this Pope guy is, because some of us have history not in this area. And a big shout out to the fact that one of his under career on Wikipedia just says crime. Big fan of that.
I'll be honest. I mostly know him from the Assassin's Creed games, where he is the main antagonist to our hero.
Assassin's Creed... And there are both Netflix and HBO series just titled Borgias that are borderline pornographic.
Thank God.
Isn't that like because like the brother-sister combo was also...
Yeah, and and he was the Pope that fucked. Like,
yeah.
The Pope that fucked!
So this isn't relevant to this podcast at all. Anyway, so... All of the early disputes rested on different variations of, well, actually, our guys saw this area first, so you can't have it. Then in May of 1789, a new Spanish military officer took charge of their trade outpost on Nootka Island and started seizing and impounding American and British ships that arrived to trade in what this new commander considered a Spanish colony.
Right.
One of the British ships he arrested was actually a merchant ship based in Guangzhou, China, and the Chinese crew were arrested and put to work building a new Spanish fort on a nearby island. Enforcement of this arrangement was uneven and heavily skewed toward capturing British ships, but all through the summer, Brits and Americans alike were chased around the Vancouver area, either being captured or narrowly escaping the Spanish Navy.
So much of colonial history is literally just finders keepers. Gimme.
Yeah.
Gimme.
I think because we're from Canada and we have such like, even when we're thinking about North America, we think about the British and the French really from like just where our location is. And we really don't go into how big and large the Spanish and Portuguese empires were and how similar they were in a lot of, like, in most ways to the British and French.
No, they just died and withered a lot earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's also because they started earlier, too.
And I think they get away with some things in most people's mind because you see it's like 1500 and it's a guy in a suit of armor with a sword and you're like, well...
How much harm can he really do?
Or it's like, well, what did you expect?
Yeah.
So the sudden burst of Spanish raids on British and American shipping drove the nations, especially Britain and Spain, to the brink of war. Fortunately for the United States, President George Washington really didn't want anything to do with European conflict, and the U.S. did not have enough of a navy to do anything, even if we wanted to.
Yeah. Hey, guys, we literally just started the country yesterday. I don't know if going into a global conflict's the move.
We can't even figure out if we are allowed to tax the sale of whiskey. Let's cool our jets here for a minute.
No, Adams, don't stop calling me king.
But your majesty. The British, on the other hand, were preparing for war with Spain.
Yeah.
The House of Commons authorized the creation of a penal colony on Nootka Island, and the Royal Navy was preparing to fight by May of 1790.
Oh, I had no clue.
That is when the English naval explorer John Meares published proof that he had actually purchased land on Nootka Island from the native Nootchak Nuth, or as the white people called them, the Nootka.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mir's purchase justified British claims to the island. And on top of that, Mears himself was a vocal advocate for breaking the Spanish trade monopoly in the Pacific by any means necessary. Early in the warmongering process, the Bourbon monarchy in France was allied with Spain and mobilized their navy. This became just one more piece of fuel on the fire that became the French Revolution a couple months later. And the National Assembly withdrew the alliance with Spain basically immediately.
Yeah. Oh, awesome.
And without France, the Spanish got a lot more reserved about their claims to the Oregon country.
Because this is also when they're kind of on the decline and England is on the rise, right? Like the
Yeah, this is after the Seven Years' War when Spain's grip on imperialism has basically collapsed. Like they are now firmly...
They're just trying to keep this. They're trying to keep the scraps that they have.
Yeah, they are now firmly on the path that will eventually lead to the Spanish-American War. The U.S. was not involved in these negotiations in any meaningful way, especially because it was such an odd moment in history. George Washington wanted no part in it, and he had just led the American army to war alongside Bourbon France and Spain against the British. On the other hand, supporting the British claim was more in America's interest at the time. So it was a very weird sort of position to put Washington in.
Yeah, and I'll be so honest, like, we're also talking about something that's happening almost like 4,000 kilometers away, or, you know, however many miles away. It's hard to really care about something that far.
Yeah, well, there was something to it. They sent letters to the negotiators saying that they wanted to own the land. Like, they were pressing a claim to it. They just weren't involved in this treaty because the U.S. really wanted a Pacific port of any kind because of trade with China being so lucrative.
But this was still at the time where they would have had to go around South America.
Well, that's why they wanted a Pacific port, was so that they could ship things overland and not have to sail all the way around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, like, Lewis and Clark hadn't even mapped a route for people to take from one side of the continent to the other yet.
This was just a really ambitious goal.
The Spanish naval commandant and the British negotiator George Vancouver actually met on the disputed island to hash things out in 1792.
Well, I had no idea that Vancouver was named after somebody.
What?
I had no idea.
And initially, this meeting was very embarrassing for George Vancouver because he was traveling when Spain and Britain reached an emergency compromise in Europe to deal with the rising threat of internationalist revolution in France. So Vancouver came into the meeting all combative and ready to demand that Nootka become a British penal colony. And his Spanish counterpart was like, hey, chill out. We're allies now.
Yeah, here, brother, here, take this. He opens his hand up. What is it? It's a chill pill.
Is this, like, so I opened a map. So are we talking about the entirety of Vancouver Island here? Or there, I found a little, there's a little island on, like, the west. It is called today Nootka Island.
It's, so the debate is about both in this case.
Oh, okay, right. Okay.
The meeting was on Nootka, the little one. And the meetings were called the Nootka Conventions. They were sort of a bust, all things considered. By the time anything happened, Spain and Britain were too worried about France to care about some islands on the American Pacific, which they both renamed the Island of Quadra and Vancouver. Then they promptly agreed to mutually abandon the islands.
I'm learning so much about this area, because there's also like a street name near us called Quadra, and it's like
that would be the Spanish negotiator.
So weird.
That's the road I lived on when we were in Victoria. It was Quadra Street.
I am perplexed right now.
So the important thing for the long term is that the Nootka Convention redefined how colonial powers could claim territory. Spain could no longer go around just saying the Pope said everything's mine and the rest of the colonial powers couldn't just claim it because they were the first white people to lay eyes on something.
Wild.
The new rule was that you actually had to establish a colony before you could claim the land. The local First Nations, of course, were too brown to own things as far as these negotiations cared.
Yeah, that's also like, that's kind of why it's almost worse, that new rule, because now you're inviting settlements onto what previously was just, oh, that's mine. No, that's mine. No, now you need to build a colony there.
Yeah.
Win some and lose some, I think.
In some case, to some people, lose everything.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of losing things, this did lead to a weird misunderstanding between the great powers. Britain interpreted this as meaning that Spain relinquished its claim to anything north of San Francisco, their northernmost colony.
That's a very convenient thing to suddenly come to a conclusion about.
It's the logical conclusion from the terms of the agreement.
From Britain's perspective.
Spain thought these were just rules to govern future colonies and maintained their claim to the Northwest. They still didn't do anything up there or particularly care about it, though.
Right. They had a lot of territory already.
Yeah. They were busy at this point with, like, stirrings of revolution of their own.
Yeah. And what, Mexico, or is this in Spain?
Mexico and South America. The first pre-revolutionary rebellions are starting to break out right around the same time. The northwestern corner of the Americas came up again in 1819 because of events on the far side of the continent. As a new British ally that had been worried about the U.S. and its expansionism for some time, Spain joined the British in the War of 1812. Also known as the War of the British burning Washington, D.C. to the fucking ground, and the U.S. pretending that this was somehow a win.
I do like how this is brought up every episode so far.
The most important thing to ever happen in our shared history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 1812 will be its own series at some point. I just wasn't planning on doing this as a series. So this ignited hostilities on the American border with the Spanish colonies in Florida, including the native Seminole people and Black people who had escaped slavery in the American South. Andrew Genocidier Jackson actually commanded several invasions and raids into the Floridas that culminated in the Adams-Onis Treaty of 1819. Obviously, I'm skipping past a lot here because the annexation of Florida will also be its own series at some point. For now, the important thing is that the Adams-Onis Treaty is usually remembered as that time the U.S. made the worst purchase in history and bought Florida.
Yeah.
But one of the other places in that agreement was Spain ceding its claim to anything north of the 42nd parallel to the United States, creating the Oregon Country and formally extending the U.S. from sea to shining sea for the first time, and giving us like some actual legitimate claim to territory that we could argue with the British about.
Now our goal of getting from here to Oregon is we could actually start, you know, paving a way there.
Yeah.
So yeah, Andrew Jackson invaded Florida and conquered Oregon.
Right.
I'm glad. I love history.
Because that is how politics works.
That is literally two directly opposite parts of that country.
You literally could not get further away and still be in the continental United States. This came as a surprise to the British, who were really under the impression that Spain had given them all of that territory in the Nootka Conventions. But the U.S. Americans had already started pouring into Oregon basically as soon as a route from the Pacific to the Mississippi had been mapped. The British wanted it. The Americans were there and had been there for almost 20 years. While all of this was going on,
right.
Russia still maintained their own claim to the whole region, plus all of modern Alaska, and the Russian-American company had fur trading outposts dotting the coast, especially further north. The problem with this was that there's not a ton of food and shelter to go around up there, unless, as the indigenous people of the Arctic Circle all over the globe could have told them, staying supplied is your full-time job.
Probably did tell them, but the Russians, just like every other colonial power, what do they know?
They've only lived here for thousands of years.
It's cold where we live too, don't they know?
Of course, the fur traders couldn't keep up with both survival and fur trapping, so the Russian colonies were reliant on imports. And as the U.S. became more and more involved on the West Coast, the Russians became dependent on American trade. An attempt to fix this in 1821 by ordering the Russian-American Company to cut off contact with all foreigners backfired spectacularly, if you consider mass starvation to be spectacular.
Yeah, that's pretty high up there.
The Russians also had a bad habit of getting shipwrecked every time they tried to establish a permanent outpost further south than, like, the modern Canadian-Alaskan border.
Okay, so they kind of, like, overextended?
No, they just weren't very good at sailing.
Yeah, I've never really heard much about Russians and sailing.
Yeah, we are a little before the Russo-Japanese War, which also, for the record, didn't go well for the Russian sailors.
Yeah, no. The Russians, they're having a pretty bad century right now.
Russia today, fantastic navy. Don't look at their aircraft carrier singular. It's made of wood. It catches on fire constantly.
Because, like, aren't they also about to be invaded?
At this point, this is just after Napoleon. So, yeah, they're not having a great time. So the Russian Empire cut new treaties with the U.S. and the U.K. in 1824 and 5, ceding their claims to anything outside of modern Alaska and establishing the border between Alaska and Canada as it exists today, which is why it has that weird little panhandle with Juneau. Just that was where the Russians had their best weather.
That's shocking. That's terrible look. That's the vacation spot.
Juneau, Alaska, known for its phenomenal weather.
Oh, yes.
So that left Britain and the U.S. as the only competitors for the Oregon country, with Britain declaring it the Columbia District under the Hudson Bay Company, and the United States calling it Oregon. In 1824, the HBC and the British Navy constructed Fort Vancouver on Vancouver Island in what is now Vancouver, Washington.
Oh.
Oh. Vancouver without the U. Damn.
No, it's still spelled with a U.
This is basically a suburb of modern Portland.
It's like just north of the river, which makes it part of Washington, but really it's in Portland.
The fort that I'm talking about in this case was on an island river, or a river island.
Yeah. Oh.
They would also found a Fort Vancouver on Vancouver Island, like where you live right now, in Vancouver, Canada.
Oh, yeah!
But they also built one a lot further south. Ooh. So they were pushing to establish themselves that far south, and the British government actually considered trying to negotiate a final partition based on this fort, with a border running along the Columbia River. However, the HBC absolutely refused to let their government give away so much prime real estate. So the Oregon country remained an open question for the next 20 years. In that time, we went through the rest of this series with all of the eastern border conflicts between the U.S. and British North America. Daniel Webster and Lord Ashburton actually tried to figure this out, but the Hudson Bay Company was insistent that the British could not cede anything north of the Columbia River under any circumstance. Webster refused to accept anything less than the modern border between the states of Oregon and Washington, which is similar in that one spot, but not all the way across. That would at least give the U.S. one major port on the Pacific, something we didn't have yet.
Huh. Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
Hello, everybody. This is Trevor Cully, host of the History of Persia podcast. From about 550 to 330 BC, most of the Middle East was ruled by the Achaemenid Persians. The Achaemenids pioneered the concept of a truly multinational empire, which incorporated people from as far away as India and Greece for over 200 years. The story of Persia discusses the fall of ancient civilizations, the origins of endurance racing, 300 Spartans, the March of the 10,000, and at least one evil priest who replaced and impersonated the king. All before falling with the dramatic close at Alexander the Great's conquests. If that story, and the story of the cultures that surround it, sound interesting to you, check out The History of Persia at historyofpersiapodcast.com, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Hello, comrades, and welcome to the podcast you are currently listening to. I promise, this isn't a Russian invasion, it's a temporary occupation. I'm Roberto, one of the hosts of the podcast, Tsar Power.
And I'm Aurora, the other half of the podcast. Together, we're ranking the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin. They will compete based on how well they fought, how successful they were in life, how much blackmail they had on them, how they look, how they died, and how long they ruled for.
After being scored, we decide whether they get to party it out in the Kremlin, because there is no party like the Communist Party, or get sent straight to the Gulag. Those who make it to the Kremlin will need to dance it out for the position of the best Russian ruler in our hit show, Dancing with the Tsars. You can find us on any podcast host as Tsar Power, and on Twitter at Tsar Power Pod, and on Facebook at Tsar Power. Our website's also tsarpower.com. That's Tsar, spelled T-S-A-R.
Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast, and if you hear a knock at the door, beware, KGB is coming to make your stay a bit more permanent.
Now, it was 1842, and the Mexican-American War had not happened yet. So California was still Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico still looked nice and big at this point.
Just hang on to this concept for a second.
Put a pin in it.
Daniel Webster floated the idea of having the British invade and conquer San Francisco and then give it to the United States in exchange for the Columbia River border.
Wow, how nice of them.
That did not go anywhere because it's a really dumb plan.
Yeah. This was one of those plans that Britain really had to like. They drew it up. They're like, all right, let's read it over again, everyone, and don't say no right away.
And they were like, no, absolutely not.
The U.S. diplomat in the background. I don't know. I like that idea. We don't have to fight.
The thing is, President Zachary Taylor just kept getting more and more hawkish, in part due to pressure from his southern base to fight the British over the issue of slavery, like we discussed last time. And every time the British turned down an offer for the Oregon border, Webster was ordered to offer fewer concessions. So he stopped bringing it up.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I don't trust a man who likes warm milk and cherries. So the joke is, that's how Zachary Taylor died. Warm milk and cherries.
Gone too late. So after the U.S. or after the U.K. refused to invade Mexico, the United States Senate passed a bill calling for a push to colonize the Pacific coast, by buying all of northern Mexico and requesting a British border at the Olympic Peninsula near modern Seattle, Washington. When both Mexico and the United Kingdom turned down that offer, Webster was told to demand extending the 49th parallel all the way to the Pacific. Of course, Lord Ashburton was told he had to turn that down because it was asking for even more. And in the end, they could not agree on the Oregon question, as it was called at the time. And as everyone who studies history knows, nothing good comes from calling something the blank question. In the meantime, American settlers in southern Oregon had started the process of forming their own territorial government, although they couldn't officially become a U.S. territory due to the disputed border. That is part of our process to statehood. You can't just have a border dispute and become a constituent part of the government.
Oh, I see.
Which actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Of course, we ignored that rule for Maine and Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota.
And Texas.
But but it's part of the law.
And Florida.
Instead, they passed what were called the Organic Laws, which is the most Oregon bullshit I've ever heard of.
Yeah, that sucks really bad. That's bad.
They thought they were clever. They thought that they were doing high fives after that.
They thought they ate.
This was a sort of legal framework for the region that allowed British subjects to participate in local government without declaring loyalty to the United States. Now, because I just mentioned it, and we did a whole episode about slavery last time, I should probably address one of these organic laws in particular. Quote, "There shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the said territory, otherwise than the punishment of crimes whereof the party shall have been duly convicted." That sounds pretty good, right?
Yeah, but
on paper,
we also know what America has to do if they're entering a state without slavery, right?
Well, they're not entering a state. This is, it's not even a territory. They haven't done that process yet.
All right, then this sounds great. Hell yeah.
Slavery as a punishment is still pretty heinous. Looking at you, California, voting yes on literally putting the word slavery on the ballot.
That's crazy.
In 2024.
What?
Oh, yeah. California had a ballot measure saying, should we ban slavery in prisons? And they voted no.
Oh, so that's like, if you are in prison, we can force you to do work and you can't say no.
Yes. Which is legal across the United States. California moved to ban it at the state level with the word slavery in the thing.
In the name.
And Californians were like, nah. So here's the thing. Oregon's looking pretty progressive at a glance. They were north of the Mason-Dixon line and just wouldn't be allowed to become a state if they legalized slavery. Instead, they passed another law in 1844 that just flat out banned Black and mixed race people from living in the Oregon country altogether.
Solves the problem. No people of color, no problem. Oregon, 1844.
In 1857, they actually proposed legalizing slavery, and that was shot down by a popular referendum because it would have meant that more Black people lived there.
Oh my God.
It's one of those sides that, like, you often get with America, where it's like you often get with the Civil War that, yes, it seems on base level that it was slavery versus anti-slavery, but the North wasn't anti-slavery. They just were pro-business, and they didn't want...
Well, they were anti-slavery, but they sure as shit weren't pro-Black.
Yeah.
So, and...
America is a parody of itself.
This remained law in Oregon until it became unconstitutional in the entire country in 1868. And even then, it took until 1925 to actually remove the Black exclusion laws from Oregon's state constitution. So yeah, that's the American settler government in Oregon. so racist they didn't want slaves because they'd have to see black people.
I'm so happy that America won against Britain and Spain in this area.
Uh-huh. back in our story, the Democratic candidate for president, James K. Polk, won the election of 1844 on an almost comically pro-war imperialist platform. It called for the annexation of Texas, California, and the entire Oregon country.
He had a four-step program that he was running, right? I will serve one term, I'll get all four of these things done, and then I will step down.
One of his campaign slogans was literally 54-40 or fight, referring to the northern border established with Russia. Despite the hawkish slogan, Oregon was actually pretty low on the priority list, but American settlers just poured in over the course of 1845 under the impression that the Oregon country was as good as theirs. So Polk opened negotiations to offer the 49th parallel as a compromise option, and in December of that year, he gave the United Kingdom a one-year ultimatum before he would call for the U.S. to seize the whole territory by force.
Nick, just so you know, Polk is like often seen as like Andrew Jackson's like kind of underling.
Oh, great.
Even his nickname, Jackson's nickname is Old Hickory, and I believe Polk like Young Hickory.
So this is Genocide Junior?
He was just so busy with fighting actual countries that the Indian wars that he ignited get brushed under the rug a little bit more.
Polk is his image in like modern history is getting revised a bit. He's kind of known as the best lesser known president. But again, like when you go and look at what he did and the four things that he accomplished, a lot of those, if not all of them, have big asterisks next to them.
I'll give him this. Motherfucker kept his campaign promises.
Oh, yeah. He said, I'll do all four of these things and step down. And he did. Like, he got all four of them done.
In his ultimatum to the British, Polk made it clear that he had no qualms about entering into a two-front war with both the UK and Mexico. Texas was invited to join the U.S. by the Taylor administration and voted yes on annexation just before Polk's inauguration. But he was the one overseeing the annexation and immediately used it to start a Texan-Mexican border dispute and provoke the Mexican army into doing something that would justify a war. Sure enough, the U.S. decided to declare war on Mexico in May of 1846.
Yes, let's show them who's boss.
This demonstrated that they were serious about conquering huge swaths of territory, and it was enough to hurry things along with the British negotiators, who accepted the 49th parallel as a border 1 month after the U.S. invaded Mexico, extending the longest straight-line border in the world a little bit further from the Rockies to the Pacific. The Hudson Bay Company divested from all of their business interests now in American territory. Oregon became a U.S. territory in 1848, and the issue was settled. Mostly. Specifically, the Oregon Treaty said that the border went along the 49th parallel of north latitude to the middle of the channel which separates the continent from offshore Vancouver Island, and then southerly through the middle of said channel and of the Strait of Juan de Fuca to the Pacific Ocean.
Okay, I was going to say, this is feeling more like America versus Spain and Britain than it is against Canada, but I think that's because I'm looking at the bigger picture here.
So far, it has been very grand geopolitics, and this treaty is where we get down to the minutia. Because once again, we run into that issue of a border drawn by people who understood most of the geography involved, but not the finer details.
There's an island there? What?
Well, it turns out there is a cluster of islands in the middle of the Strait of San Juan.
What?
And George's Strait, called the San Juan Islands.
Is that where our ferry goes through? Or am I just thinking of... That is where the ferry...
Yeah, there's the San Juan Islands, and then there's the Gulf Islands, and the Gulf Islands are just the same islands except north of the border, and then the San Juan, it's where we, yeah, the ones we see.
Okay, yeah, because in order for us to easily get from Vancouver Island to Vancouver, you have to take a ferry from Victoria to Vancouver, and it goes past all these islands.
Yeah, so that is the islands, and that is what we're dealing with today, is those islands.
That's so cool.
I've taken a little prop plane over to those islands, and then the guy, the pilot, he said, "Do you want to do a loop?" And I said, "Fuck yeah, I want to do a loop." And then so he did a big loop in the sky, and I was with my dad's like coworker at the time who was afraid of heights, and he's shitting himself, and I'm like 9, and I'm like, "Fuck yeah, loop!"
No, I'm not going on a plane. That's going loops.
Loops.
I barely want to get on a plane at all.
Look, if it's a plane made in Seattle right now, fuck no.
Yeah.
Neither of the most common maps available at the time were very accurate to these islands, making them look like they were further away from Vancouver than they really are. In reality, there is not a single channel that runs directly through the middle of the straits. And that brings us to today's most direct military confrontation. Have y'all ever heard of the Pig War?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually.
That is today's final topic. And this is not to be confused with the US versus Canada in the Pork and Beans War, which is another name for the Aroostook War from episode 2 of this series.
Yeah, but that one had no blood in it, so I'm not.
Yeah. There was a bear!
It just had like a really angry, yeah, a really angry bear, but the bear tried and still failed to kill someone, so.
Did I successfully make a Weezer joke that episode? I
I
hope I
think you
did.
did, yeah. So this is not to be confused with the Pork and Beans War, that name probably stuck because of the Pig War. The Pig War was the last violent border dispute between the US and British Canada in 1859, just a little over a decade after the rest of the border was already settled. After the Oregon Treaty, Americans were just psyched about getting to claim Puget Sound as a gigantic deepwater port in the Pacific, and they started settling what became the city of Seattle almost immediately. Within just a few years, both the British and Americans had enough of a presence in the region that they had to sort out this border discrepancy and decide which one of their countries was going to use the San Juan Islands. This was important to stuff like taxes and fishing rights and preventing smuggling, but also to military control of the Georgia Strait. Remember, the US and UK had almost gone to war at least twice, depending on how you count, in the preceding 12 years. Both sides were very worried about this sort of thing.
And this one's a lot farther from home for both of them.
Yeah, and this would be a pain in the ass to fight about.
Yeah, it almost feels like this would have to be fought in other places as well.
Just because that's where there are people.
Yeah.
So in 1856, they agreed to form a joint border committee with negotiators meeting on the HMS Satellite to argue and sail around the islands, trying to see what exactly they had to work with. There were basically three options. You could draw the border along the Haro Strait on the west side of the San Juan Archipelago and give all of the islands to the US. You could draw it along the Rosario Strait on the eastern side and give all of the islands to the UK. Or you could draw it through the very narrow strait between San Juan, the biggest island, on the west side, and the rest of the smaller islands on the east side, and split the chain between both countries. Of course, US negotiators were absolutely certain that the correct interpretation was to follow the Haro Strait, and the British were equally certain that it was supposed to be the Rosario. The middle option was suggested as a compromise, but it was just too narrow to be practical. You couldn't actually sail much through it, so it didn't make a lot of
Right.
sense. On top of the obvious land grabs, both sides had actual merit. By the wording of the original treaty, The border was supposed to flow through a strait that separated Vancouver from the continent. It was supposed to be navigable to shipping and be, quote, thence southerly through the middle of said channel. The current of the Rosario Strait runs south while the Haro pushes north. So the British argued that that meant it was the border. The Americans said, no, the treaty is just telling you what direction to draw the goddamn line. And the Haro Channel that actually separates Vancouver from other land masses is supposed to be the border. Honestly, after reading a lot of border treaties for this series and actually looking at the maps used in the Oregon Treaty negotiations, I feel like the Americans are definitely correct so far as the intention of the original treaty is concerned. But I would be curious to know what you think.
Map time.
Map time, map time.
Here we have the map made by an American cartographer.
All right. And that's not where the ferry would go through, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Is it? Okay.
I feel like if you're looking at this map, it's pretty clear that they mean that you're supposed to draw the line on the western side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
wow. And is that a map that they had?
Yeah, that is a map made by an American cartographer at the time. And this one that I'm going to share now is the map drawn by George Vancouver.
Okay.
So again, he kind of pushes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The islands a little too far to the east. But if you're looking at that map, it's kind of hard to see why you would draw a line on the eastern side of the island.
Honestly, it looks like Vancouver Island is just too close to the continent.
Yeah, definitely. That is,
like, you got to push that out a bit. Because then you could fit all those islands in between the island and the continent.
Yeah, the other, I hate to say I'm with the Americans on this one, but I do think I am.
Like, these are the two maps we know they looked at during the negotiations. And it's hard to see how you could come up with the British border suggestion from those documents. Negotiators couldn't agree in 1857. They packed up and went home to deal with the San Juan issue another day. Basically, as soon as they left, civilian interests on both sides moved to reinforce their own country's claims, with the Hudson Bay Company setting up shop on San Juan Island to turn the whole thing into a big sheep herding ranch.
Okay, good. Wow.
Then just under 30 Americans moved to the island to set up various businesses of their own, which really speaks to the different colonial ethos of either side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Britain wants to colonize something, send a gigantic corporation that's basically a government unto itself. America wants to colonize something, send two dozen madmen with axes and too much free time.
Yep.
No women, no problem. Let's cut down these trees.
Also, for the record, these islands had once been home to people from a whole bunch of First Nations that used them as outposts for fishing and trapping. But at least on the San Juan Islands themselves, there wasn't much indigenous presence by the 1850s. Like a lot of these places at the fringes of early American and Canadian colonization, it's not that the colonial powers wouldn't have committed genocide there on purpose. It just happened mostly by accident before white people cared enough about the area to do it. While the British and Spanish were still trying to figure out what exactly this area even looked like in the 1770s, somebody inadvertently introduced smallpox to the local population, resulting in a plague that killed so many people, the San Juan Islands were abandoned.
We've seen it before. Just terrible.
On the subject of atrocities against the disenfranchised people of North America, I would be remiss if I didn't address the San Juan Islands' bizarre relationship to the American Civil War.
Oh, great!
One of the weird little twists of this show is that the Civil War is emphatically not a secret.
Yeah, I would say so.
But it overshadows a ton of smaller conflicts in the decades before and after it. So I routinely come back to this period where history is full of very famous names in military history going off on bizarre little side quests. At this time, even though the army was much smaller than it is today, it actually had a much larger role in American domestic affairs, mostly because we weren't sending it all over the world instead.
Right.
And
centralized.
Yeah. Well, and because the United States was a country full of smaller countries that were here first to start wars with. Anyway, the logistics for all of that were divided up into regional army departments. And in 1858, a new brigadier general was put in charge of the Oregon Department, William S. Harney.
Harney. Mm.
To his extremely minor credit, General Harney did not join the Confederacy later in life.
Wow.
But as a loyalist from Tennessee with a lot of Confederate family, who did very little to prevent the rebels from trying to seize an armory in his territory when the war started, he also doesn't exactly earn a gold star.
Are you from Tennessee? Because there's only 10 slaves I can see.
Ooh, that might be the worst one yet, Bailey. Oh,
Jesus. Our cat woke up from that, dude. He's pissed.
Early in his military career, George Harney, or was it George or William? William Harney.
William.
Some white guy name.
William Harney started with being personally recommended to the Navy by Andrew fucking Jackson.
Great.
Then deciding he liked Jackson so much, he'd join the army instead. Serving future President Zachary Taylor as his assistant, fighting in just a shitload of wars with indigenous people, the Mexican-American War, and beating an enslaved woman to death in St. Louis.
That's a crazy resume.
When Harney arrived in Oregon, he shuffled some things around in his command structure to place Captain and later Confederate General George Pickett in command of his troops.
Pickett.
They were near Puget Sound, Washington, and Pickett, most famous for getting hundreds of his own men killed in a worthless charge at the Battle of Gettysburg, is a weird little guy in his own right.
Yeah.
He was born in Illinois and went to Springfield to study law, where he met and received advice from another young Springfield lawyer, literally Abraham Lincoln.
What the fuck?
Pickett then moved on to West Point Military College and graduated just in time for the Mexican-American War.
Yeah. I think he went with Grant. I think he was there at the same time as Grant.
Pickett and Grant and Lee and Jefferson Davis were all there, and most of them threw a drunken riot on Christmas.
Thank God.
Yeah, and I think that's the funniest thing about it is that, like, when Grant was going to, like, West Point, it was basically all the future leaders of the Confederacy and the Union, all friends. So even when they were doing their peace agreements, they've all known each other since they were in their early 20s.
They were all in the same fraternities.
Yeah.
Like, again, America has an aristocracy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unlike Harney, Pickett wasn't a big wars with indigenous people guy. After Mexico, he was stationed in Texas, where he got married, only for his wife to die in childbirth a few years before Pickett went off to the Washington Territory.
Mm.
There, he remarried to an indigenous Haida woman.
Oh,
yeah.
She also died of tuberculosis, but not before she and the future Confederate war hero had a mixed race son.
Okay. Oh.
And let me guess, super nice to his son.
Yeah, of course. Like, I said he's a weird guy. Once they were both in the Northwest, several of Harney and Pickett's own friends and later comrades would allege that they conspired together to start a war with the British Empire.
Ah, lofty goals. That's what we're aiming for.
General George McClellan, later overall commander of the Union Army at the outset of the Civil War, and one of Pickett's classmates from West Point, claimed that Pickett and Harney wanted a war with Britain to prevent the American Civil War. You know, find a common enemy sort of thing.
Yeah.
Another general who was stationed in Washington at the time said no. Actually, they wanted a war with Britain to make it even easier for the South to secede. But there is a pretty constant theme here, and part of it is a guy from Illinois wanted the South to secede for some reason.
Never underestimate the power of a guy from Illinois.
No, Abraham Lincoln, also a guy from Illinois.
There you go. What? That's what I'm saying.
The main problem of the last, like, what, three presidents before, even four presidents before Lincoln, they were all Northerners with Southern sympathies.
Yeah, basically. Then everything changed on the morning of June 15th, 1859, when an American farmer named Lyman Cutler.
What a cool name.
Lyman?
Lyman Cutler? Oh, that's a name to be remembered.
He went out into his garden on San Juan Island and very nearly started the war for them. That was the day that Lyman found a pig eating his potatoes.
Oh my God.
This was not the first time that this sinister swine had infiltrated Lyman's crops. So he shot that motherfucker.
I'll be honest. I don't care how this goes. I love Lyman. Lyman Cutler's my hero.
Sorry. Okay. First of all, what kind of fucking name is Lyman? Bro's mom didn't know if she liked limes or lemons better and said, fuck it, Lyman. Or alternatively, she went into her fridge and grabbed some lemonade and went, okay, limonade. Because that's what it says in French is Lyman. His name is fucking Lemon in French.
I am Limon Colère.
Yeah, he wasn't French, but he talked like that, so.
It turns out that this pig actually belonged to Charles Griffin, worked on the Hudson Bay Company's nearby sheep ranch. Lyman offered $10 compensation.
Okay, that's
$340 in modern USD.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
That's a pretty good for a pig.
Yeah.
Griffin demanded 10 times that.
Okay, so 100, so like $3,000 modern.
Yeah. For the record, the average price for a livestock pig today, according to livestockmarket.com, is about $318, which frankly is remarkably consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People are talking about inflation. Okay.
So still, the British authorities threatened to arrest Lyman, and his neighbors sent word to the mainland calling for military protection. This is a sign that the United States has grown up as a country a little bit, because his neighbors didn't, like, invade Britain.
Yeah. And you know what? We acknowledge growth where we see it.
Yeah.
His neighbors didn't just immediately stab a judge.
Okay, I had to Google Lyman. His name is spelled with a Y. I feel a little bit better. I was in my head, L-I-M-O-N, Lyman. And that's why I was like, ain't no fucking way. This is a real dude.
No, L-Y-M-A-N.
Okay, markedly better.
So George Pickett sailed over to San Juan Island with 66 men from the U.S. 9th Infantry, while the warship USS Massachusetts floated ominously nearby.
Ah.
In response, Fort Vancouver dispatched three ships, including the HMS Satellite, which had previously hosted negotiations to prevent exactly this problem from occurring.
That's a cool name for a ship.
The Satellite?
The Satellite?
Yeah.
This is like pre-satellites, so this is a pretty cool...
Yeah, it's the HMS circles around you.
Bailey is currently learning that the word satellite does not mean the things in space. I'd like to put that out there.
So both the U.S. Army and the Royal Marines established camps on opposite ends of San Juan Island, including a fortified redoubt built by the Americans, which is still pretty well preserved today. Over the next few weeks, soldiers flooded in to both sides. Then Colonel Silas Casey took over from Pickett by the time the American force reached 461 men and 14 cannons.
Holy shit.
For this little tiny island in St. George Strait.
America.
The British had sent another 5 warships, bringing their total up to 70 cannons and 2,000 men.
Ah.
And this is on San Juan Island.
Yes.
I've been there. There's not enough room for all of these people.
They're just piled. They're packed in there. Arm in arm.
Yeah, you'd have to be.
You know, hang on to that.
Oh, no.
James Douglas, the governor of Vancouver, which was its own colony at the time, ordered his side to, quote, dislodge the American, but also to avoid armed conflict.
Ah.
Of course.
The British Admiral Robert Baines said that he absolutely would not start a war over some farmers arguing about a pig.
Absolutely not.
Right, of course. I believe you.
Me and my 70 guns are not going to be starting a fight. Me and my 2,000 men were here as peacekeepers.
So the question of what to do next, now that the US and UK were once again aiming their guns at one another, was passed up the chain of command. Thankfully, technology had progressed quite a lot over the preceding decade and a half.
Aircraft carriers.
Almost. The first attempt at the transatlantic telegraph had failed the previous year, but between ships, horses, and railways, and overland telegraph, it was faster than ever to get a message from the Georgia Strait to Washington and London. Mm-hmm. And both of the home governments were horrified when they found out what was going on.
They did what? A pig did what?
Go out, have fun, but come back before the streetlights come on and it's like dusk, and then you get a call and it's just fucking kids screaming at each other outside. It's like, what have you been doing? Neighborhood war. Pellet guns are going off.
So Governor Douglas was ordered to negotiate a peaceful settlement with the Americans. And American President James Buchanan was desperate to get the situation under control. Buchanan will always go down in history as one of the most worthless presidents.
One of the?
In the United States' entire history. But to be honest, he was just the last guy in a long series of people who had done as little as possible to soothe domestic tensions in the U.S.
Admittedly, that was his whole life as president.
By 1859, he was overseeing a country barreling towards civil war and an election year where keeping his own pro-slavery Democratic Party in power really looked like the only way to postpone the crisis. Even though he had no intention of running for a second term, and it was starting to sound like there might be 4 separate Democratic candidates. So he did what any reasonable president trying to avert a war on the northern border would do, and sent General Winfield Scott to the disputed territory for negotiations.
Scott, isn't he like 800 years old at this time?
I cannot stress enough that he was still general of the army and also 73 years old.
That guy, I believe he was like born near the foundation of the country.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So what you're telling me is old fucking men in the United States will flock to positions of power.
No, it's funny because when the Civil War first kicked off, Lincoln went to Scott and was like, you're our first choice. And Scott said, I think I'm too old for this. I think it's time to retire.
And Scott said, I am 75.
I think it's time for me to go home.
He was born before peace with Britain. So Scott arrived in Vancouver that October.
Really?
From the far side of the continent.
Because I know quite a bit about Scott.
Are we in Vancouver, Washington, or are we here?
Vancouver, Canada.
Where we are. Okay.
I had no clue that he came here.
Yeah, he went to Vancouver October of 1859, after 4 months of military buildup on San Juan Island.
Wow.
He walked the seawall. He went to Gas Town. He saw the steam clock.
Yeah, so just taking a bunch of pictures on his way, him and his men. He's just old guy.
So 73-year-old Winfield Scott and his British counterparts were equally eager to resolve all of this without bloodshed and agreed to a joint occupation of San Juan Island, with no more than 100 troops from either side to be stationed there at any given time. This lasted for 12 years, despite the HBC and the government of Vancouver Colony all but begging Parliament to let them seize the island by force when the American Civil War started.
Yeah, well, like, they do think they're part of the war, so...
Well, London refused in part because San Juan was hardly their biggest concern in North America at the time. The Confederate States kept trying to convince them to invade, and they were busy reconfiguring the entire industrial economy of the British Empire around Indian cotton.
And also, I believe that Britain was also hesitant because they got rid of slavery like a couple decades earlier. And it would look bad going in and supporting a nation against another nation when one's literally fighting for slavery.
France even more was like, no, we are not getting involved in this. We will blockade them for you, but we're not getting involved.
Yeah.
No cannon shots will be fired. Yeah, we left our cannons at home.
They really did not want to get involved in the war over something as banal as a couple of rocky islands.
And a pig.
Instead, the American and British garrisons on San Juan just kind of hung out together while most of the other American troops in the area were recalled further east to participate in the war. And a volunteer militia had to take over the job of being the local military on the lookout for Confederate pirates, because the men of the 9th Infantry stationed on San Juan had to keep staring at the Brits. And the Confederate pirates thing was a very real threat. We've talked before on this podcast about the CSS Alabama's expedition to raid shipping in Eastern Asia, which led to the U.S. invading Japan in 1863.
Yep.
And the American consul in Vancouver spent most of the war terrified that the British colonial government was going to support rebel privateers operating out of their territory. In the years immediately after the American Civil War, the British were busy reorganizing their North American colonies, in part because America kept fucking with them.
Yeah.
There were additional raids into Canada during and after the Civil War, which I will talk about some other time to keep this series focused on the border disputes.
Like, at this point, there are, like, with raids and all this stuff, there are casualties happening here. People are dying on each side, or is this remained relatively, because everyone's too scared to kill anybody?
So after the Civil War, you get the Fenian raids, which is like pitched battles with Irish rebels. I don't remember what the name for it is, but there was one American raid into Canada during the Civil War that was really tiny, but there were a couple of casualties.
So everyone is still trying to maintain, we're not fully committing to this war.
Right. That is the story of this series.
That bear was looking for war, though.
Yeah. Unofficial British support for the Confederacy led the U.S. to withdraw a free trade policy, and the Alaska Purchase in 1867 had the British colonies feeling a little bit surrounded.
Yeah.
On top of that, Canadian political reform had never gone away as a movement, just become less militant. And since the formation of the Province of Canada, a distinct Canadian identity had finally emerged beyond just being British colonies.
Yeah.
So in 1867, pressure mounted far enough that the eastern provinces all voted to form the Crown Dominion of Canada.
The mighty name.
Yep.
This is when Ontario and Quebec became the official names for the provinces.
Mm-hmm.
Manitoba, the Northwest Territories, British Columbia, which now included Vancouver, and Prince Edward Island, all joined within just a couple of years. When British Columbia became part of Canada, there was a small problem. If they wanted the autonomy of having their own national government, they needed to resolve their own border disputes.
You can't be trying to make claims of being your own independent area when you can't even solve problems on your own.
And the British were concerned that if they gave that independence to Canada before figuring things out with the U.S. could steamroll the Canadians, which they absolutely would have.
Yeah, the one's established.
So the British imperial government reached out to President Ulysses Simpson Grant to see about resolving the San Juan Islands dispute once and for all. Per their existing treaties, they needed an external arbitrator. So both sides reached out to a brand new country at the time.
Ooh.
Germany, with Kaiser Wilhelm I acting as the arbitrator in the negotiations.
Yes. Right. Beginning of the Second Reich.
He was selected because both countries wanted to kiss up to the new German government. But everyone met in Geneva, Switzerland to hash things out. Though the negotiators actually went to Washington, D.C. to sign the physical treaty. The Treaty of Washington, as it is called in the United States, ballooned into an oddly significant piece of international precedent. That is probably reflected better in its British title. The Treaty Between Her Majesty and the United States of America for the amicable settlement of all causes of difference between the two countries.
I love Britain.
Right, of course.
I love how they talk.
Obviously.
In the final product, the U.S. got all of the San Juan Islands and drew the border down the Haro Strait, but that was one of many lingering disputes in the Treaty of Washington. Raids into British territory and seized goods during the Civil War had left a lot of financial damage on the table, as had British seizure of American ships, including slave ships like the Creole from our last episode. Mm. There was also ongoing debate on how exactly either side was allowed to use the rivers along the shared border. Plus, Canada had to send its own representatives to sign this time.
Ooh, they got a seat at the table.
So what happened here is they tallied everything up, damages on both sides, to come to, you know, a financial penalty for one side or the other. And in the final estimation, the British owed the United States $15.5 million in 1870s money.
Holy shit.
Oh, and the San Juan Islands.
All right, this is what we want. We want $15 million, the San Juan Islands, and your biggest apologies.
Everyone got to go home with no more border disputes or financial obligations to the other side, and British Columbia got to become part of Canada.
Ooh.
It also established rules for being neutral in one another's wars that became a cornerstone of international law. It required due diligence to maintain neutrality, established that you couldn't retroactively approve a breach in neutrality just because it benefited your side, and established the concept of legal extraterritoriality, which means things like diplomatic immunity and the concept of international waters, which has come up in recent days in the United States because people don't understand what this treaty actually fucking says.
It must be so aggravating reading all these treaties and then hearing people just like who have never read it and have just heard about it being like, this is what it means.
Actually, the plane was over international waters. All of these principles went on to be incorporated into larger European treaties and the United Nations Charter. Both sides withdrew their troops from the San Juan Islands by 1874. And in 1966, the United States made San Juan Island a national park with monuments to both the British and American camps, including a Union Jack on the site of the British encampment maintained by National Park Rangers. just a fair warning to you, if you want to visit, you'll have to go into the rest of Washington State and loop back around, because that ferry line that normally goes to the park from Victoria is closed for the rest of the decade.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Yeah. I looked on their website just
it's
to...
It's the V2V, isn't it?
Just to tell people about it. And it was like closed until 2034.
Okay, fair enough.
I gotta look it up. Well, they closed during... I found... Okay, so visit the San Juans. It was a thing because I had some friends visit in like 2019 from Seattle. They took that ferry up to see me when I first moved to Victoria. And then COVID hit. And they took that as an excuse to just like never run again. But I guess they're still an incorporated company and they won't just give that up. But nope, it's... Yeah.
Wow.
As I understand it, they took it as an excuse to sell their boats and retrofit new ones. But that is the story of the Oregon border dispute, the Pig War, and the end of our series.
Ta-da!
How's everyone feeling here?
You did an amazing job at making each episode better than the last one.
Yeah. Because
like episode 4 was definitely like my favorite. As soon as we finished it, we were like, wow, what a good episode. And I like this episode more.
Yeah, that was so good. And Bailey Douglas, we talked about General Douglas. Yep. Douglas College down the road.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, thank you both so much for doing this ridiculous series with me.
No, this was so fun.
The series that was never supposed to exist and has turned out to be
extremely relevant.
Oddly prescient the entire time we've been working on it.
Yeah.
The first episode is the only one that we were completely ignorant of everything.
Blissfully ignorant.
Like, there was some rumblings in the air, but it was not big enough for us to talk about.
Yeah, he had, like, said some 51st state shit on the campaign trail, but nobody cared.
Yeah, because, like, that's crazy. Who would listen?
Yeah. Well, now I can begin work on the Greenland episode.
Oh, God.
It's only part of a joke. I'm not doing that next, but there is a Greenland episode.
I'm sure there is.
But yeah, there's not like grand historical lessons to take away from this. No. It's kind of a bunch of trivia strung together in a narrative.
It's super interesting because they don't like, at least in the last, 80 so years or even over 150 years, Canada and America have been really close. And so these kind of wars that you hear between the countries aren't brought up. And even like the whole thing with the White House, the British did that. We're close friends. We would never do that to each other.
Yeah.
Right? When they came and took York in like, modern day Toronto, that was just them going after the British, not after us, right? And so it's interesting seeing kind of the things that led us to being friends and how bloody it was at times.
And it's one of the interesting themes that developed as I was working on the whole series was how intrinsically tied to these, border skirmishes, the story of Canada's development as an independent, autonomous nation was.
Yeah.
Like, it was very directly linked to events sparked by border disputes with the United States, where it was really America beefing with the UK that like spun up events in Canadian politics and vice versa.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And it's impressive that like Canada, I believe, and I could be wrong, but I almost like 100% sure Canada's only bordering neighbor is the US.
It is. I guess technically we're bordering France from that one small little island next to PEI.
I love French colonies. Like they just pop up in the weirdest places.
It's literally like 5 kilometers by 5 kilometers, and it's next to PEI and it's France.
Yeah, you got that. You got Greenland and then us.
Yeah, right. And the fact that there's only been like pretty damn minor wars. Even if you're talking about like the invasions of each other's countries right at the beginning for all the kind of set all this off,
I mean, the most violent episode in the series was episode 3, when America supported and also didn't support at the same time Canadian rebels. Like,
yeah.
If I were to like give a historical moral of the story to cap this all off, especially where things are in the current political moment, this, you know, the relationship between the US and Canada was not sealed in blood, but it wasn't for a lack of trying.
Yeah.
We take it for granted because it never blew out of hand, but that took a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And decades and decades.
A lot of people got screwed over in the process over the course of about 30 years. We have quite seriously undone approximately 150 years of goodwill in the course of 2 months. And that is ridiculous.
It is honestly like the climate here. I've been like talking to a lot of American folks because I don't know if they necessarily realize what it's like to be in Canada at this moment. I've never seen our country this united. Like in terms of like everywhere you go, you're seeing Canadian flags. Like in the States, I notice this whenever I cross the border, there are American flags everywhere. And it's weird. Because it's not like that here. Like, every house has an American flag on their, like, doorstep. People have them in their homes. Like, it's not like that here. But lately, it has been very... You're looking at me. But lately, it has been very... There are Canadian flags on storefronts. There are Buy Canadian, We Are Canadian. And it's just weird. Because it's never... Patriotism has never been a thing.
You're seeing conservatives and liberals and NDP all standing side by side.
Yeah.
Almost in solidarity with we've never seen before.
Yeah.
I am a little too young to attest to this directly, but it's something I've heard from literally everyone within a decade older than me or a decade or two older than me. Culturally, we just 9/11'd Canada.
Yeah.
That's the shift that like that's the same shift people describe happening in the US after 9/11 is that kind of like setting aside domestic political differences and embracing ostentatious patriotism. We've 9/11'd Canada, people. What the fuck are we doing?
Like, it's been bizarre. It's been like, even me, like, I'm not necessarily a patriot as who I am in terms of, like, my political stance and whatnot, but it's been, like, I found myself going to the grocery store making sure the milk I buy is Canadian, and it's, like, in my head, I'm like, why the fuck do I care? But also, never will you unite people more than a common enemy, and that's what the U.S. has made itself to us.
One of the biggest figures in our current history is the conservative leader of Ontario, Doug Ford. And he has for a long time had only the conservatives as his support. And the farthest away you can get from him is Green and NDP parties. And both of those parties have supporters that are looking at a man who just weeks and months ago, we were all looking like, oh, this guy's crazy. And we're like, yeah, Doug, let's go, Doug.
He's the brother of the guy who snorted cocaine during the campaign.
I was just going to say, not to be confused with the cocaine one.
So it's been weird. It's a weird time to be, especially because I'm dual. I'm both Canadian and American. And it's been weird. My dad crosses the border every day. And like, it's weird. But it's been, my dad has been getting worried about crossing the border every day for sure, and like especially because he works there, if he gets a new border guard and it's like, oh, are you going to work, where's your work visa, and it's like, I swear I'm an American citizen, so that's why he's been bringing his passport, because he could very well be detained if they think he's going to work illegally in the States for a day, like
great, this
again
we did the culture, we had the cultural effect of fucking 9/11 on Canada. God damn.
And unlike America, we did nothing.
Yeah.
America was doing things that warranted a retaliation.
And we're literally just sitting up here chilling. All we're doing is talking about how much we hate Pee-Pee, who's the head of the Conservatives. Like, that's it. Yeah. So topical podcast. Is what we're trying to say.
Inadvertently topical podcast.
I think I stand for a lot of people in Canada, though, that does see that this isn't what most Americans want. And I believe that it will mend relationships if not in the next 4 or 8 or 12 years, but eventually, once whatever is going on with this certain Republican Party, because everyone knows this won't last forever, but it's just fingers crossed. Yeah, but unless the world ends, the parties will eventually change, and when that happens, hopefully things aren't too far gone, right? Hopefully
that, or you'll have like 3 to 5 new neighbors on the on your southern border.
Oh God,
Indian Stream will rise again.
I vote for the bear, personally.
In the meantime, everybody go back and listen to part 3 about joint Canadian-American rebel operations crossing the border.
Yeah, we're besties. Stronger together, as Mark Carney, our current prime minister, would say.
All right, let's wrap this up with where people can find you two on the internet.
You could find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, pretty much everywhere you find your podcatchers. And we are also on Blue Sky and Threads. And if you're on Facebook and you need a place to find us, Totalis Groupium. It has a lot of podcasts that are primarily Rexy Pods, which is the genre of podcasts we are.
Excellent. And if anybody wants to find me on the internet, I request that first you leave a nice review for this show on your podcast app of choice. I know a lot of you followed me here from History of Persia, but remember, this one is new, so it needs that little bit of a boost. And then you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia, or go to hopfulmedia.com. Go to hopfulmedia.com.co to support the show financially or buy merch. And until next time, the U.S. Army Guide to Sabotage is freely available and in the public domain.
Goodbye, everyone.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.